Our position rankings continue. It's safeties this week, the most interesting men on the defensive side of the ball. We've got two Ravens, a pair of Seahawks, of course, and a 2016 Defensive Player of the Year candidate misses the cut. All that on the MMQB 10 Things podcast.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling.
Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. I am Gary Gramling. I am here with Andy Benoit, as always, and we continue our position rankings as we go through the offseason here. Today, it is safeties. Safety, I feel like that is a position that is near and dear to your heart right now, Andy.
Yeah, I do talk a lot about that position, don't I? And
It's good stuff.
It is good. Well, it's because it's an evolving position. So last week we talked about tight ends, top 10 tight ends, and we said at the top of the show, this is where the schematic evolution of offense is stemming from. Safeties are the counterparts to tight ends, and we're seeing they drive the evolution of scheme, at least in today's NFL. More teams are playing multiple safeties, like three safeties in their base packages, which become sub-packages, nickel, dime. Safeties are all over the place. It's now almost more common. It's becoming more common to see three safeties on the field rather than three linebackers.
Well, I was going to say, toward the end of last week's show, when we were talking about Jordan Reed, we sort of posed the question, if you're a defensive coordinator and you have Jordan Reed and Vernon Davis on the field against you, what do you do? Do you put in an extra defensive back? And the answer is kind of, well, if you have three good safeties, maybe that's not such a problem for you.
Because you need someone that can defend the run and the pass. You need a hybrid flexible position to respond to the offense's hybrid flexible position, because that's the value of two tight ends. You can pass or throw out of it, and you can go into any formation with those guys. Safeties are the counterpart to that. And right now, by the way, there are a ton of good safeties in the NFL.
There are. It was actually this was a difficult list to pare down. There's one guy, and obviously we will wrap it up with others receiving votes at the end of this. There's one guy who didn't make our list, who I was shocked that didn't make our list. He was getting Defensive Player of the Year consideration last season, and he ended up 11th on our list. So we won't have him in the proper countdown. But like I said, we will get to him once we get through the top 10. If you are joining us for the first time, or if you have been joining us frequently and you just are very forgetful, the way we do this, it's AP poll style. Andy, myself, and this week our researcher is Katie Sharp. We all submit our top 15 at each position, this week being safeties, of course. And then you get, a player gets a first place vote, gets 15 points, second place vote, 14 points, all the way down to 15th place vote gets 1 point. And Andy's votes count double. So he gets a little more weight right there. And we will count down the top 10 according to our results here. And let's jump into it.
Number 10.
At number 10, we have the newest Baltimore Raven. That is Tony Jefferson. He is a former Arizona Cardinal, and he's a guy you spent a lot of time with last free agency period.
Yeah, I did. I was with him all day on the first day of free agency, and he was getting phone calls nonstop, text messages nonstop, but we hung out and drove around the area. He lives in San Diego, and coincidentally, Eric Weddle was the guy that was texting and calling him the most, and that's who he wound up going to play with, but not in San Diego. He went to join him in Baltimore, and I think they're going to have a pretty good thing there.
They are, yeah. They have a they have a really good pair of safeties right there. Not to spoil it, but Eric Weddle will come up later in the show. Jefferson, he's a guy who went undrafted, didn't test particularly well. And, he has certainly outplayed his measurables. If you are a measurables type of guy and you lock into that sort of thing. But really interesting stat here. Again, Katie Sharp helping us out with the research. Tony Jefferson had 13 tackles for loss last year, which led all defensive backs and actually matched Von Miller, of all people, who, of course, topped our edge rusher show. So that's a flexible dude right there.
Well, and the reason why he had all those tackles for loss is James Betcher in Arizona. He likes to blitz a safety off the edge on second down, on early downs at times. And the reason for that is because that blitzing safety serves as an extra run defender. And so, and Jefferson's flexible enough that if he can have a blitz call on and then see that the running back releases into a route and he can come off of his blitz and go pick up the running back. He's a versatile player down near the line of scrimmage, and they're very aggressive there in Arizona, and he's excellent coming. He has great feel for angles, so he's going to get those tackles for losses. They especially like to blitz him in late moment situations, close games when the ball's kind of near scoring position. That's where they send their blitzes the most. I don't think Jefferson's going to play that way as much in Baltimore. I know that people probably think the Ravens are an aggressive, multiple attacking type of defense. Mm-hmm. They really had not been that the last couple of years. Style. Last season, they were very cover two driven, very vanilla zone driven. Dean Pease is their coordinator there, and he plays to his personnel a lot. So he'll probably be a little more aggressive with Jefferson. But Dean Pease philosophically is not James Betcher. He's more conservative than that, and I think that's going to work out fine for Baltimore.
And how, in your mind, how does Jefferson stack up in coverage?
Excellent. That's why I had him in my top 10.
Yeah.
Because in this, he's really improved steadily over the course of his career in all facets. That's how you become. He left college early and then went undrafted, had some injury issues, as you said, mm-hmm. didn't test well, and played more each year since then. What didn't play as a rookie very much, didn't play much as a second year guy. But in his third season, he showed the ability to cover tight ends in space. And guys would split out wide in the red zone and he'd take them. And then eventually he was doing it outside the red zone more. So he's improved a lot as a cover guy. And the important thing, Gareth, a lot of these guys we're going to talk about, and this is why the Jets went after Tony Jefferson and why the Jets took Jamal Adams, number 6 overall, and Marcus May after him. Mm-hmm. You have to have the ability to begin in zone coverage and convert your zone coverage into man coverage if you're going to play safety in the NFL. Because so many teams are doing matchup zone stuff. Now, Baltimore, they don't do a lot of it. They were more of a spot drop team, meaning you guard your area of the field. You don't match up to whoever comes into your area of the field. But I would imagine if they want to become a matchup zone team, they could do that now because Jefferson is outstanding at turning his zone coverage into man coverage on the fly.
Spot drop. That's a new one for me. So basically dropping to a spot on
you
the
drop
field.
Drop to a spot. It's the Lovie Smith defense, and I'll be honest with you, I'm not a fan of it. I think it's very exploitable. It's very predictable. And the teams that do it best tend to have matchup elements wrinkled into it anyway. So
yeah.
if the ball's on one side of the field, say it's on the left hash, that creates more space on the right side of the field. And the more space there is, the harder it is to be a spot drop team because the spots become bigger. So
yeah. It's
if you're just a spot drop team, I don't think that works anymore. It worked when it worked a few years ago, worked 15 years ago. But the teams that are best are the ones that match up. And I think Baltimore will match up more out of it now that they've got Jefferson there to do it with.
Yeah, that's kind of a league-wide thing, and I think it's something we're going to talk about a lot in 2017, sort of, you have to match up now. Steelers were just, Artie Burns, our buddy Artie Burns was just talking about the other day at OTAs, you can't, the old Dick LeBeau zone blitz thing, it's not what they're going to do anymore. Everyone who covers well uses man coverage.
And even Dick LeBeau himself in Tennessee last
yeah.
year in the second half of the season, they were predominantly a man coverage team. I thought it was one of the most interesting shifts we've seen philosophically from any coach in a long time. Dick LeBeau's in his 80s, and he's
yeah.
changing his scheme a little bit now. And his scheme was groundbreaking and changed football. You could argue changed it forever, or at least what we thought was forever. It's kind of going the other way now. Man coverage ability, and it's not just straight man-to-man. It's the ability to become a man defender at any point. That's what's important.
Yep.
Number 9.
This is Tony Jefferson's ex-teammate in Arizona, Tyrann Mathieu. This was a guy who, he had a little bit of a down year last year coming off the second ACL injury, so We'll see if he can stay on the field. He's been very good some seasons when he has, and certainly he's still one of the best at the position.
If he can stay healthy, I think people can, even if you don't follow the schemes and nuances of strategy, you can watch the Cardinals and know that Tyrann Mathieu is a unique player. I mean, he jumps off the screen. So we don't need to take people through that so much. It's his deal right now, it's very simple. If he stays healthy this season, even if he doesn't play particularly well, but he stays on the field, he's going to keep his long-term contract that they signed him to. If he doesn't stay on the field, he's not going to be he won't be on that contract next year. The Cardinals can get out of it. They would get out of it. This is a big year for Mathieu because he has to stay healthy this time. He's too good of a talent not to. And the concern, Gary, especially with Jefferson gone now, is where do you play Mathieu and that can also keep him healthy? When he's had the knee injuries, it's hard to put him in the slot because now you're shifting and changing directions. That puts a lot of stress on your knee. So he plays more free safety rather than slot. Already that's a problem because he's so dynamic as a slot guy. But now with Jefferson gone, does Mathieu have to play more strong safety? Does he match up to tight ends at points? And if that's the case, he's too little to be playing in traffic every single down. So it's weird because his style of play doesn't match his body type. He plays so much bigger than he is, and sometimes that punishes him.
Yeah, you know, I kind of wonder, the old rule of thumb, and I don't have formal medical training, I know that will surprise many of you, but the old rule of thumb was, after an ACL injury, it's that second full season back is when you get full confidence in the knee again. And I wonder if they'll move him back into that slot role, because I feel like that is what made him special. You know, he does other things well, but that ability to come down and cover the slot is what made Mathieu a very valuable piece of that defense. And on top of that, I mean, he got paid, and the Cardinals did not pay a handful of other guys who got away, Tony Jefferson, Calais Campbell. It's a make or break year for Mathieu, and it's kind of a make or break year for, I don't know, I guess looking back on that decision that the Cardinals made two off-seasons ago.
It is, and let's keep in mind, they also drafted Buda Baker this year, and they can use all the safeties they want. And that's a team that does play three safeties. You could argue they play four if Deion Buchanan, in your mind, is still a safety. He's clearly a linebacker now, but he came in as a safety, into the NFL. Buda Baker's like Mathieu, stylistically and even size-wise. He's a tad bigger than Mathieu. It's interesting. They've got a lot of similar pieces now. At least they have two similar dynamic pieces there. But Mathieu will drive the ship. Buda Baker is not going to supplant Mathieu at all if Mathieu plays even 80% as well as he's capable of playing and stays healthy.
Yeah. Well, let's and they, by the way, they also added Antoine Bethea this offseason. So yeah, they have a whole bunch of safeties now out there.
Number eight.
This is Eric Weddle, and sort of a testament to the old guys here, the fact that you can play safety effectively deep into your career.
And what he does is so based on disguises. He does a lot of individual disguising, a little bit like what Troy Polamalu used to do.
Yes.
Not quite that aggressive, but that's the nature of his game. Savvy, smart, veteran player, still moves around just fine. Not perfect, but moves around just fine. And I think having him and Jefferson together, both of those guys are versatile enough, they'll be able to disguise together.
Yeah, and Weddle, you know, he'll be 33 in January, and he's still going plenty strong, and he's got a new playing mate out there in Baltimore. Let's actually jump ahead.
Number seven,
and this is Byron Jones, University of Connecticut alum. Byron Jones, now perhaps more importantly, of the Dallas Cowboys. And, you know, we talked a little bit about this, during the free agency period. Cowboys had a lot of changeover at cornerback, and they kind of restocked what they had there, but they didn't really restock at safety. So, you know, Jones was a guy who came down, played the slot a lot his first two seasons. It seems like they're sort of gearing up to have him play more of a traditional sort of center fielder type of role in Dallas this year.
Yeah, it does, because their other safeties, Jeff Heath, who is a fringe starter, he's been kind of a high-level backup for a lot of years. Robert Blanton, a journeyman high-level backup as well, more of a backup than Heath, really. And then Xavier Woods, their fifth-round pick. You don't draft a guy in the fifth round with the intention of starting him immediately. You might, but that's not, you know, that's not at the forefront of your thinking. So I would be disappointed if Jones is just a single high safety, which I could see him because of who else is around him. I could see him falling into that role.
Mm-hmm.
Gary, you and I have been infatuated with him for 3 years now because he is a top-level talent as an outside corner, as a nickel slot, as a zone slot, which means basically a hybrid linebacker, and as a strong and free safety. He can play five positions, and he's a special teamer, too, to boot, as Katie Sharp points out for us. So to just place him in center field, he'll be good at that, but he's special because of all the things that he can do. The Cowboys, though, interestingly, they're not that kind of defense. They're not a highly schemed matchup defense. They're more of a classic zone team, and you don't move your players around in that kind of scheme so much.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, just looking at the depth chart here, I mean, they are actually, if the two guys they drafted work out, and they drafted Chidobe Awuzie and Jordan Lewis fairly high, they have plenty of depth at cornerback. I mean, they supposedly had Orlando Scandrick on the trade block and didn't move him, and you got Anthony Brown, and they brought in Nolan Carroll. So that's a whole lot of corners. I don't see any scenario where Byron Jones plays any sort of a cornerback role this year.
Yeah, you're right. And Brown and Scandrick, incidentally, they have both been very good outside and in the slot. So if you add them plus Jones, and I don't think this is coincidental at all, those three guys, Jones, Scandrick, Brown, they're the three that the Cowboys kept. They essentially let everybody else in their secondary leave. Those three guys can play anywhere in the secondary. So I think it makes it easier to incorporate rookies because you can put the rookie in his optimum position because the other guys can play anywhere. So put them wherever the rookie's least comfortable. I would imagine Scandrick, they like him. He's on a good contract. I bet he wasn't aggressively on the trading block, but he'll have to play well to stay on the team this year because I think Anthony Brown is a rising young talent at corner. I know they don't feel the same. The fans in Dallas don't, but I know for certain the coaches do. So I think the secondary can be very good, but it's young and it might take a little while.
Yeah.
Number six.
This is TJ Ward, one of my favorites. I thought I was going to have TJ Ward like second or third on my list, and I couldn't in good conscience put him higher than fifth, and he ends up sixth on our poll. I think he does the two-way thing as well as any safety in the league as far as run support and the ability to come down and cover tight ends and some slot receivers.
That's the difference. So he's got the same thing that Jefferson had. Ward, early in his career, was just a thumper in Cleveland. And towards the end of his Browns tenure, he became very good in man coverage against tight ends. Then he got good at guarding them in space, so not just when they're up on the line of scrimmage. And now he's a movable chess piece in Denver's defense. And that's valuable because they've got all those man-to-man corners. So you say, Roby, you take one guy. Chris Harris, you take the other guy. Tlaib, you take that guy. That leaves us eight defenders. We're going to move and buzz these eight defenders around, and that's where the disguises come from. Mm-hmm. You can get a very multiple defense out of that, and having the safety who can also play man coverage, that's what allows for the rest of those disguises to take place. So TJ Ward, he is good at everything he does. He is just a good high-level football player. He really doesn't have a weakness.
Yeah, and you know, you had some changeover, obviously. Wade Phillips is now in L.A. You have Vance Joseph coming in, and Joe Woods is a defensive coordinator, but you figure it's going to be Joseph's defense. Based on what Joseph did in Miami last year, and granted, when you don't have this kind of talent, you can't be as versatile. Do you think we'll see any sort of major departure from what Wade Phillips used to do with this group?
I don't. The more I think about it and the more I ask around the league privately, the more I think we're going to see Denver do kind of what they've been doing. Remember when Mike Tomlin became the Steelers head coach? Tomlin had been in Minnesota and under the Tony Dungy tree, and he was one of these Tampa 2 zone type coaches, similar to what Joseph is.
Yep.
And Tomlin, Tomlin, to his immense credit, and nobody ever talks about this, when he went to Pittsburgh, he looked around and said, we've got Dick LeBeau coordinating, Hall of Fame level coordinator. We have 3-4 personnel at all three levels, outstanding outside linebackers. We're going to stay as a 3-4 team. I'm not going to try to make this a Mike Tomlin defense. And that's what they've done. I think Vance Joseph will do the same thing. And talking around the league, the belief in the NFL is really John Elway has his fingerprints so much on that team that it'll probably be Elway's decision. And Elway's going to, my guess is Elway will want to stick with what Wade Phillips has done because Elway has a Super Bowl ring from that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you figure any tweaks you're going to do will come. And we talked a little bit about it. Actually, we talked a little bit about it when we talked about Tevin Coleman last year or a couple shows ago. You know, they got to do something about their linebackers just getting fried in coverage by some of these opposing chess pieces.
Well, and that was one thing. If you do have a gripe with Wade Phillips, it's that you could manipulate matchups against him out of certain base personnel groupings and formations. In other words, we're going to keep only two wide receivers on the field, put in two tight ends or two running backs, and we're lining up in what looks like a running formation, and we're going to throw out of this grouping. Teams had a good feel for what Wade Phillips would do against that, and that's when Denver got exploited. That's one thing I know Joseph is going to be very diligent about cleaning up, and they're going to change a little bit scheme. I don't know in what way, but they're very aware that that was a problem last year, and that's one of the things Joseph is there to address.
Absolutely.
Number four.
Let's move on here. We actually had a tie for fourth, so this would be we have no fifth place. These two were tied for fourth. Let's start with Devin McCourty, New England Patriots, the converted cornerback who, obviously at this point, he's going to stay at safety forever. And, you know, he's you got to love his range out there and the fact that, you know, he's a guy they use on a lot of those double team bracket coverage looks.
Yeah, he is. Good point. And also, because he's another one who can, because he's a former corner, he can also go on his own in man coverage, which allows for those double-team brackets to go elsewhere. And that's very important. When you have safeties, again, we can't stress this enough. When you have safeties that can cover, your scheme becomes almost limitless. And McCourty gives them that element. And I know I like watching him on film, Gary, because he just plays the safety position the way you want it played. There aren't a lot of, wow, look at that. It's just the safety's where he's supposed to be. It can be easy to overlook that and make it go unrecognized. It's important to remember how vital McCourty is to what they do there in New England.
Yeah, and speaking of guys who are vital to what his defense does, tied with McCourty for fourth, this is Cam Chancellor. You know, let's start with the X's and O's with Chancellor. What's the term, Andy? High hole safety for that Pete Carroll defense.
So in the Pete Carroll defense, there it's known as a 3-over-4-under coverage, and what that means, the 3-over players are the two outside cornerbacks and the free safety Earl Thomas. They're over the top. The linebackers and the slot corner and then the other safety, they're the under guys. They're underneath. And why Chancellor is special is because he can play that underneath coverage really high. So his underneath coverage almost plays as if he's part of the over coverage, but he's not. He's part of the under coverage. And that makes it harder to get vertical routes against him. It's threatening to come over the middle because Chancellor gets ahead of steam when he's running to break up that pass or running to drill the receiver in the middle of the field. That's why he's so valuable. It takes, as Dan Quinn once told me, it takes a real man to play the high hole, because here's the other part. And the high hole is one of those under positions. You're still an active run defender. You still have a run gap. You're a primary run defender. So to play deeper back and still be viable against the run, you've got to be fierce. You've got to be fast. You can't make mistakes. You need to know where you're going. And Chancellor does all of those things. He's the difference in Seattle's defense. He's what makes it a very potent cover three as opposed to just everybody else's cover three.
Yeah, and I think, and I know we don't like getting into intangibles too much in this show, but the physicality he brings, and I think the Seahawks are one of the best at basically playing physical and not crossing that line into, you know, we're in an era where you're penalized if you hit outside the strike zone. I mean, you know, it's easy to pick up flags, and they certainly toe the line in everything they do. But you know, I think the physicality of Chancellor over the middle gives them an edge that you know, when he's been out the last 2 years, when he's missed some games, I think they missed it. I mean, I think there's something to be said for just having a guy who is this much of a badass in the middle of the field, and sort of what he does for I don't want to say confidence, but it kind of is confidence for the rest of your unit.
Yeah, it's the tone-setting stuff. And would you believe this, by the way? I had a great conversation with Cam Chancellor after the Bills game, which was, he sat out that game. It was a Monday night game.
Yeah.
He was hurt last year. But we went through some of these route rules for defending these routes out of cover three. And I braced myself for the handshake. Very gentle. It was a very gentle handshake.
Really?
I felt like I was kind of the aggressor, in fact.
Would
you have ever
shocking.
Guessed that? Yeah,
no.
It is shocking. Some of these athletes, remember I told you, what was it, Gronkowski talk?
Gronk last week, yeah.
Yeah, this is a lot of hand conversation. But some of these guys have these strong hands, and you can tell they've gone through their life learning to not use them on civilians. You get some really dainty handshakes in the NFL because those hands can crush you without the player even thinking about it.
Well, I hear Adrian Peterson has the roughest vice grip.
Have I told you my story on that?
No.
So
I've heard it from other. I've heard other people tell stories about shaking hands with Adrian Peterson, though.
Well, so at the Super Bowl, I forget what year. It was the year Adrian Peterson won the MVP. So what did that? What did the 2012 probably? It was the Super Bowl in New Orleans. I've heard the handshake thing as well. Apparently, it's just bone crushing. And I wanted to shake his hand just to experience it. And he was holding his daughter. I think it was his daughter or maybe his son, whatever. He had a baby with a kid, like a two-year-old with him. And so I thought the next best thing is his dad's hand. I heard he learned it from his dad. So I went up to Mr. Peterson. I said, I've heard about the handshake. I just want to experience it. You know, can I shake your hand or will you shake mine is really what I was asking. And he said, yeah, I taught my boy, just put it, get in a good grip there and let them know your presence. And I said that as he's shaking my hand. I don't know if I didn't get my hand all the way in there. You know how sometimes you just come up a little short and you're really like tickling fingers at that point. It's horrible. Everybody hates that. I don't know if that's whatever it was, all of my fingers crunched into just one enterprise, and it was just an enterprise of pain. It was a sharp pain. It wasn't thick. It wasn't achy. It just hurt like hell. It was so sharp, and it was hard to move my fingers after that. I mean, I thought maybe he'd done something. And so then a little later, I saw Robert Klemko on the bus. This was before MMQB. This is like a half hour later. And I extended my hand to say hello. He was at USA Today at the time, so I didn't know him very well. I extended my hand to say hello, remembered how much pain my hand was in, and instinctively withdrew it. Like I was like, you know, faking him out. And that's the handshake story. I got my hand shaken. It hurt for about a half hour, like actively hurt. And it wasn't until 24 hours later that I could no longer feel the remnants.
I was going to say, and circling back to Cam Chancellor, who started this all and had a, as you said, fairly unimpressive strength to his handshake, I wonder if just all your nerve endings are dead in your hand at this point. And maybe that was the – maybe you have the equivalent of like Buster Bluth from Arrested Development, the rubber hand. Yeah.
Well, I was griped. I saw on the bus, I said to Ryan Wilson from CBS, another good friend of mine, I said, who can go through life shaking hands like that? How does he get away with that?
Yeah.
And Ryan Wilson said, well, did you say something to him about it? And I said, no, of course not. And he goes, that's how.
Oh, man. This was handshakes and sweatpants. That's going to be the alternate title of this podcast going forward. Cam Chancellor, and we should mention Cam Chancellor going into the last year of that 4-year contract. So he has the, as Katie Sharp points out for us, this is the he has the highest cap hit of any strong safety in 2017. So we'll have to see how this plays out with Chancellor's contract. Because
I would imagine they'd want him back. I know they drafted Tedrick Thompson in the fourth round. They also took Delano Hill in the third round. So they've restocked the depth at safety. But they've done that. That's normal Seahawks drafting, too. Chancellor's not – I don't think he's 30 years old yet, is he?
He'll be 30 next April.
Yeah. A lot of safeties have played well into their 30s. Brian Dawkins, John Lynch, Aeneas Williams. I mean, there's been a lot. I think he could be that kind of guy. He's not. They don't rely on him to run and change directions a ton. He's more of an enforcer type. Now, they are playing more man coverage, though, and you wonder if they want to keep doing that. Maybe then you wonder if he's going to be worth the price tag next year. Whatever his price tag is, I guess that'll be what decides it.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'll just say two quick things. I don't think there's any chance they move on unless they are somehow 100% sure that Chancellor is entering the decline phase of his career. But I mean, look, yeah, we mentioned the physicality, and he is a guy. He held out for two games, but he missed, I believe, three games due to injury in 2015, and he missed four games last year. So, I wouldn't have full confidence. I think you'd feel good about where he is right now at his age, that he probably has a good 4 or 5 years left, but I don't know how confident you can be in that at this point.
Yeah.
All right, just a little bit of housekeeping before we move on to the top three safeties in the NFL. Of course, if you missed the first three shows in the series, you can go back, get it in our feed. We did running backs, we did edge rushers, and we did tight ends. And we'll have all these coming up. I think we'll maybe be delving into some offensive line next show. Maybe. We'll have to figure it out. I guess receivers are still out
every
there,
time
too.
Every time you've done this, where you say, well, we might do that one next, we've wound up doing it. So it's offensive line. Gary just decided.
Because no one ever objects. I rule this thing with an iron fist here, I guess. But, so that's – I mean, look, that show's always a little bit more for the connoisseurs. So, you know, look forward to the – it's always good discussion, but look forward to the offensive line talk next show. Other than that, as always, we say, please subscribe to the show. If you have friends, tell your friends to subscribe to our show, or at least give it a listen. Give us a try. We're pretty likable. We're all right. They might stick around. And if you haven't already, please do leave a review on iTunes/Apple Podcasts, as they call it now. It helps other people find the show. Strangers. Maybe you'll make some friends somehow through leaving reviews on iTunes.
Number three.
All right. Let's go ahead. Let's rip open the top three here. At number three, we have Harrison Smith, Minnesota Vikings. Certainly it's a team that doesn't get a whole lot of publicity. It's a team that lacks a whole lot of Q rating, especially with Adrian Peterson gone now. But Harrison Smith has been a rock for a good five seasons here.
And let's start with the basic. He doesn't miss open field tackles. He's a great open field tackler, and he can pursue and still make the tackle. He's become a little more versatile under Mike Zimmer, which you have to be to play for Zimmer. And that scheme, the safety and his ability to come off the edge as a blitzer, or even more importantly, the ability to line up as a blitzer and then not come and find your landmark, find your location, find your assignment, that's critical. That's a big part of what they do. That's where their schematic flexibility comes from. That's why people don't like playing against Zimmer. And Harrison Smith's the big guy behind it.
Yeah, I mean, he, the only thing I'd sort of put the asterisk on with him, weirdly enough, he had no forced turnovers last year. He had two fumble recoveries, but he had no interceptions, no forced fumbles. That's kind of weird.
Interesting. Yeah, I wouldn't have guessed that. Keep in mind, I learned this once when I went to NFL Films. I was getting tutoring. I mean, we were learning very specific things, and I said, I want to learn about safety play. Let's put on Ed Reed's interceptions over the last few years and see them. And the takeaway was that interceptions, forced turnovers by safeties, as we're kind of characterizing, a lot of it's circumstantial too. I mean, I'm not saying Ed Reed wasn't great and didn't get interceptions that other guys would not get, but you still get tip balls. The safety is a reactive position. It's a very reactive position. So the forced turnovers can be a little bit misleading with those guys. It's not like defensive ends who can go get the ball on a sack fumble. These guys have to wait and see what happens before they can do anything. They're not the aggressors most of the time.
Number two.
Well, actually, that's a good segue. Let's jump ahead to number two. This is Eric Berry. And Eric Berry, of course, he was a touchdown machine last year. And he is a little Katie Sharp stat right here. Returned 5 of his 14 career interceptions for touchdowns, which is wild. I mean, everyone remembers the win they had in Atlanta, that Chiefs win down in Atlanta, where he had the pick two to seal it. I mean, he's become a big play guy, and for a guy who kind of, has a reputation as being a box safety, that's a big deal.
Oh, yeah, he's more than a box safety. So here's the third guy we'll say this about, and I promise you we'll stop, I think. Eric Berry, he's a guy that was not good in man coverage early in his career. I mean, I remember Antonio Gates embarrassing him in a game back in 2013, I want to say. 2012, that's when it was. Because in 2013, Berry got pretty good in man coverage. And he actually had a he told me he had a friend that played basketball that he grew up with. So he just went and guarded the friend all offseason because the friend was so much bigger than him, which all these tight ends are bigger than these safeties. That's why they struggle at safety. And that was the difference. I mean, it was like overnight, Eric Berry learned to cover tight ends. He wasn't a stopper necessarily, but he was no longer a liability at all. Yeah. And now they don't use him on tight ends quite as much now. But they, as a free defender within the context of their scheme, and they do a lot of matchup zone, they very much do the stuff Tony Jefferson's been good at. Berry is excellent there. He can match up, and he's good at locating the ball as a free defender.
Yeah. And I mean, look, two postseasons ago, he ended up in 1-on-1 a lot with Rob Gronkowski. Now, granted, it didn't work out that well, but you know, if Bob Sutton's leaving him 1-on-1 with Rob Gronkowski, it sort of says something in the confidence your defensive coordinator has in you.
Yeah, it does. I mean, keep in mind, what else is the answer for Rob Gronkowski? I mean, my strategy would be to put 12 guys on the field so I could go 2-on-1 against Gronk at all times. But I know what you're saying. I don't disagree with it. The play, you know, that Atlanta game, Berry had that pick six as well near the end of the half against Atlanta. Do you remember the play, or at least kind of vaguely remember the people?
Yeah.
So this is an example of why safeties are, it's not always as simple as this guy's a turnover creator. That was a great play by Berry, but the issue on that was the receiver on the backside did not threaten his route vertically. I went over this play with very closely after the season. And so anyway, the play design was supposed to threaten Berry with a receiver into his zone. The receiver did not run a good route, and so Berry was not threatened, which meant Berry was free to now leave his zone. And so he did, and I think that's a great illustration of a few things. One, it's that you're dependent on a lot of stuff around you. So it's not just that safety's a playmaker and that one's not. If someone had come into Berry's zone, Berry's never able to jump that route, and we don't think about him, and we're not getting his pick six information from Katie Sharp because it's not as impressive. But no one did. But at the same time, Berry had the awareness to understand I am a free defender now, and I can go do that. And it's called football IQ or just football instinct. So there's a lot that goes into it. And I go back to this is why I get in. How do you grade this stuff? Like if a receiver doesn't run into the safety zone when he's supposed to and the safety therefore can make a play, how do we grade that? Was that a great play by the safety? Was that just a bad play by the receiver? It's a mix of both. And I don't think you can put finite numbers on these things. Safeties are a difficult, difficult position to grade.
Yeah, and I mean, look, instincts and awareness, it's kind of terms that get thrown around, but it's the fact that you can basically play at your normal playing speed and make decisions like that and not sort of be, you know, slowing yourself down with the process of thinking about what you have to do next.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And not to pour any cold water on Berry as we leave and go to number one here, but, you know, he's not flawless either. I don't think I maybe had him too. I mean, he's a good player, but there are times where he did not execute his assignment last season. He didn't get the job done mentally. He had a few mistakes. I think that needs to get cleaned up for Eric Berry to be everything he's capable of being.
Number one.
Well, with that, now that we've bashed Eric Berry, let's go on. Number one, the unanimous number one on our safety countdown. This is Earl Thomas. And look, when we did this list a year ago when we counted down the safeties, and by the way, we'll publish these lists at the end of the year this year. I said we'd do it last year, and we didn't. We won't do the individual votes, but we'll give you the recap of where guys were last year and where they were this year. Earl Thomas, we said he had never missed a game. And what would happen if he missed games? Like Cam Chancellor missed a couple games in 2015. And look, we saw it last year. And granted, Seahawks had injury issues elsewhere in the secondary. But this was a drastically different defense without Earl Thomas.
No question. No, and the numbers back that up. And we'll probably recite some of those numbers for you. The film backs it up. Stephen Terrell, you don't want to rag on a guy, but missed tackles were a real problem. He was not a good enough tackler to be your last line of defense. And Earl Thomas has that element, and he has the range. He covers so much ground. When your safety can do that and the guys around him know he can do that, those guys around him can become a lot more aggressive. Cam Chancellor, we talked about him. He can hit it hard downhill, be a thumper, because he doesn't have to worry about the safety behind him. Has more range. He doesn't have to worry about the safety blowing an assignment. When your free safety is good, everyone around you is free to play to their best ability.
Yeah, it's and the stat real quick. This is week 14 to the end of the regular season. This is courtesy Katie Sharp. Seahawks allowed the fifth highest passer rating and third highest yards per attempt in football, 105 and 7.7 respectively. And that's not what you see from a defense that has been absolutely elite for the last 4 years.
No, it's a different defense without Earl Thomas, and that's been true for quite a while now. In fact, I mean, he's been great. So, I mean, he's Hall of Famer, I would assume. I mean, what he came in 2010, if I recall.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I mean, look, there was when he broke his leg last year. There was the sort of emotional tweet where Earl Thomas said, "Maybe I'll just retire," or whatever it was. I can't remember exactly how he phrased it, but it didn't seem to be very. It wasn't something to be taken that seriously, but, if that was it, if it was seven seasons, I don't know, is he a Hall of Famer? You figure it's since he's going to come back now and probably play 4 or 5 more years at a high level. Yeah. I mean, definitely he's on a trajectory to be the Hall of Fame, but if he walked away then, it would be really interesting.
That's why I hate the Terrell Davis selection to the Hall of Fame, because it complicates it now.
I was going to say, I think it opens the door for guys like that. I would
Which
have said
complicates it. The more, that means more guys can rush through the door for the Hall of Fame. I mean, like,
yeah.
So, and this is not what we're talking about. So, hold on. Terrell Davis had like 3 great seasons, right?
Yes.
And Earl Thomas has been 4-time first team All Pro. He's had four. He's probably been the best free safety in football 4 years, and it would have been 5 years last year if he didn't get hurt. So he has played his job and done his job as well as Terrell Davis ever did his job. So why wouldn't Earl Thomas be in? I hate that a guy can have 3 great seasons and become a Hall of Famer, because now it's hard. I mean, is Priest Holmes a Hall of Famer? Because he had 3 great seasons too at the end of his career in Kansas City.
He did. Door might
the Terrell
be open.
Davis thing makes us hard. If Thomas the other retired thing with, today...
The other thing that Davis with Davis though is the fact that he was arguably the best postseason running back of all time, and that I think is what tipped the scales in his favor. And I think you couldn't say that about Priest Holmes, but you could say that about Earl Thomas, because he's won a Super Bowl and he's been to another one and he's played at a high level in those games.
Yeah, the guy that's going to be the guy that will be hard is Patrick Willis, because he's going to be the discussion of was he around long enough, and he doesn't have the postseason argument that you made, which is probably what tipped it in that voters room. You're right.
Ooh, that is Willis is going to be really good. That will be interesting.
It will. You could argue, though, because Terrell Davis is a Hall of Famer, I bet 8 of the guys on this list have had 3 phenomenal seasons in their career and have done something in the playoffs. I mean, it's probably for another show. I don't know how I get into running back Hall of Fame on our safety show. They're literally line up as far away from each other as you can possibly
exactly.
line up. But you get what I'm saying. Is I wonder if Earl Thomas, if he stopped today, if he would be a first ballot Hall of Famer, just a Hall of Famer in general. I would think he should be based on what they're allowing in or who they're allowing in now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's jump ahead. Let's recap the others receiving votes right here, because this I do want to talk about one of these guys. So of course this would start at number 11, and we had 19 guys get votes here. So 11th is Landon Collins. Then we had Rashad Jones, Morgan Burnett, Malcolm Jenkins, Keanu Neal, Haha Clinton Dix, Jonathan Cyprian, Patrick Chung, and Barry Church. And look, Collins is a guy I want to talk about. I was sure he'd be in the countdown, even though I only voted him 10. I couldn't convince myself to put him above any of the 9 guys ahead of him. But he got a 6 from Katie, he got a 10 from me, and he got a 13 from you. But I mean, look, he was a guy who was in the Defensive Player of the Year discussion last year. I don't want to say it was not legitimate. He was very good last year. But when I look at Collins, I kind of think of him in the same vein that I think of Vic Beasley, in that he's sort of a guy that he's a little bit limited, and he has a defensive coordinator who sort of makes sure that the things he does exceptionally well, he does a lot.
Yeah, and by the way, that's the definition of good coaching. That's
yes.
their job, and Dan Quinn did it well with Beasley. Beasley needs space around him in order to be an effective pass rusher, and they find ways to do that in Atlanta. And Steve Spagnuolo has done a great job with Landon Collins. Collins is not a good cover guy. You can't ask him. So the theme of the show, these guys that can match up in man coverage. I left Collins off my list. I wasn't punishing him. It's just you can't do that with Collins. So you become more limited. Now the Giants have the unique position of having – they're the only other team besides Denver that has three sensational cover corners. So they're able to account for that, and that allows Collins a little bit more flexibility here. They're not quite as reliant on him. And they have found ways to make Landon Collins a downhill player, and they've done a lot of things to accommodate his nature. He can be those guys that go downhill, that hit it hard downhill like he does. This is why Cam Chancellor's special again. Those guys can be vulnerable to misdirection and play action and matchup problems, and the Giants have done a great job curtailing that with Collins. He really only blew two coverages last year. But we're talking about a guy that you have to work around still. They're working around Collins, and that's to their credit, and that's to Collins' credit. He has answered well, and he's found his niche.
Yeah, we talked about a couple guys on this list throughout who were not good cover guys early in their career and got better. Do you think Collins might fit that mold? Look, he's a guy who I thought they should just move to linebacker last year.
I think, and you're not the only one that has thought that. And there are people in high, powerful positions that have thought that about Collins. And that might happen someday with more teams playing dime. Again, Deion Buchanan? That's what you have to wonder. And he's not that yet. I think he's fine how they have it. But if he were to go in one direction or the other, he's closer to linebacker than he is to corner right now. In other words, he's not. Jefferson was further along. Barry was further along. The TJ Ward, he was further along. I think Collins is a little too behind in coverage. If he does it, I'll be extremely impressed.
Yeah. Well, our Giants fan producer, Lou Pellegrino, is surely shaking his fist in anger as he listens to this conversation.
A lot of people will. I mean, we're going to get tweeted about this a lot. I bet half of our listeners probably believe Collins would have been top five in anybody's list.
Yeah. We're going to hear from John Jerry again, aren't we?
Yeah. Did we hear
from
him?
Or that guy posing as John Jerry.
Yeah, that's right. What did we hear from him again? What was that?
I don't know. We didn't. I'll reach out to him.
Oh, that's right. You feared we would. Yeah, we're fine. Okay, but John Jerry's not coming after us.
I'll check in with him. Yeah, that was the bet, whether it was actually John Jerry or not. But I'll reach out to that dude on Twitter and sort of – I'll DM him. I'll follow him, and we'll be following each other. I'll DM him and – and I think that's how things work in today's technologically advanced society. If you want to find out if someone is John Jerry, you can find out.
Yes, you can.
And that's
John Jerry
wrap
can't play. John Jerry can't play man coverage either. By the way, just
cannot.
To bring this full circle,
he cannot. Oh, that's a wrap for this show. As we said, I think it's going to be offensive line coming up next week. Maybe offensive tackles. That's the discussion we have to have. Do we split it this year? That I'm not sure about. We didn't last year.
I think
some
we
people...
go all one. You guys are making me do this top 500 player stuff, so I've been thinking about that and going through lists. And what has stood out is there are not very many good offensive linemen in the NFL right now. Not very many great ones, let's put it that way.
That's a good point. Maybe we do keep it as one then, and we'll just invite your hate mail for a second straight year for those of you who wanted more offensive line talk. But that's it for this show. Thank you to Katie Sharp, our researcher this week. Notes were great, making us sound smart. And, of course, thank you to Lou Pellegrino, our producer every week, and editor Chris Basil, always making us sound good. Those guys at Digital Media, they are gods among men. But most of all, thank you to all of you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. As I say every week, we'll do a mailbag show or two before the offseason is out. So do keep those questions coming in. We will do as many as we can. Andy_Benoit, GGremling_SI. That is Twitter. Facebook, we're both on there. We have our actual names on there, so just search for that. Or you can do talkback at themmqb.com. Even if you don't have a question, just write in with your your criticism or your praise, perhaps. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB Podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB Podcast with Peter King, and of course this podcast, the MMQB 10 Things Podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.